Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the IA podcast. I'm Emily Carver and I'm Head of Media at the Institute of Economic Affairs. In today's episode, I'm joined by Andy Mayer, Chief Operating Officer at the Institute of Economic Affairs, who has recently written on why critical race theory has no place in the workplace, and we're going to find out how the Institute of Economic Affairs would deal with claims of racism. So Andy, could you start by giving us a brief overview of what you understand by critical race theory?
Well, thank you, Emily, and thank you for that excellent introduction. I'd like to start by unpacking this a little, before diving into what is quite a complex area of theory. So first of all, let's be very clear, it was completely right that the murder of George Floyd drew attention to the problem of police brutality in the US. Something that appears to have racial motivations, although this is contested by various people. And it's a problem that seems to be best addressed through police reform, in many ways learning from the UK, where the issue is far less prevalent, although there are still protests from time to time about the way that the British police behaved in their treatment of suspects in custody. But let's treat the murder as the trigger for this latest exposition of what people are calling the culture wars. So what happened? Well, after the event, the film of the murder went viral globally. It sparked protests throughout the summer of 2020 and beyond, and it was energized by the Black Lives Matter movement. Led to protests against police brutality in many countries and sparked a wider debate about a range of issues on race, particularly anti-black racism in majority white countries. In the UK, the debate was characterised less by protests against brutality and more by a general assault on our apparently racist culture, generally led by activists from the radical left, but also including a wide number of people without strong political backgrounds and generally younger people. This led first on assaults on cultural artefacts. So famously, the statue of Bristol slaver Edward Colston was thrown into the harbour. And less pleasantly, it led to assaults on police officers who were trying to police protests during a pandemic, including bricks being thrown at their horses, or mostly peaceful protests, as the BBC rather disgracefully put it. There were claims of colonialism levelled at the proms, most specifically the singing of Land and Hope and Glory in Rule Britannia. These did not succeed. There are attempts to get old TV shows with unsound values cancelled forever. There are many reasons not to watch Little Britain. Faux outrage about blackface makeup and cultural appropriation, otherwise known as acting, is just fairly sinister. The historian David Starkey got himself cancelled, unusually in this crisis, for saying something that was actually racist. Politicians and celebrities otherwise fell over themselves to apologise for any offence they might have caused and promised to do better, it not always being apparent, even to them, that they knew what doing better actually meant, but all of them got much better at kneeling. Behind the scenes in boardrooms, government, local authorities and schools, and most visibly on the pitch, there's been a general reappraisal of culture and policy, sometimes visible symbols of solidarity, such as bending the knee at football games, sometimes training and listening exercises, to which we'll come back to in a bit. That's how we got here. What's less well understood is the ideology behind it. So just to be clear, it's not just opposition to racism or being anti-racist. It's a specific kind of anti-racism packaged up and grounded in a suite of ideas and ideologies favoured on the authoritarian left. These are ideas rooted in postmodernism and critical race theory. These ideas are attempting to change the narrative on race relations, but not in a way that is particularly helpful. So let's start with postmodernism. Postmodernism was a reaction to modernism, both of which are huge cultural and ideological movements of the 19th and 20th century that are about far more things than just this issue. Imagine, for example, the straight-line industrial conformity of brutalist architecture in the City of London versus the wacky eclectic curves and form of Gehry's Guggenheim Museum as examples of the difference. But in this context, it's the ideology of postmodernism that we're looking at. It can be boiled down to a form of relativism. It's a sceptical treatment and rejection of grand narrative theories of history. So these include Enlightenment rationality, science, liberalism, and ideas of objective truth in everything from religion to arts and culture. Narrative is what we say it is. We should be sceptical of all claims otherwise and define our own truth based on lived experience. It's associated particularly with the French philosophers such as Derrida and Foucault. One idea to emerge from this via the 1920s and 30s Frankfurt School is critical theory, or social critiques meant to affect social change by understanding errors in dominant narratives of history as they compare to the lived human experience. Or less academically, when history is written by the winning side, what do they get wrong? What does the losing side want to say? What is their truth? We can, for example, look at the British narrative of ending of slavery. Our belief that it shows heroic British abolitionists, backed by British naval power, enforcing the end of this wretched trade throughout the empire. This versus the lived experience of those enslaved by the British over the centuries. Crimes of empire, compensation for slavers, and the rather long path from protests in the coffee houses of London to actual abolition. Clearly, there's more than one story of slavery. Postmodernism and critical theory are not always wrong, they're just useful tools of analysis. But there is no universal truth other than slavery is wrong. And if we reject all universal truth, then even this becomes unclear. So postmodernism can be something of a self-defeating narrative. Critical race theory as a strand of both emerges from postmodernism in the sense of looking at history as a struggle of power struggles between different groups. It emerges from critical theory by looking at those clashes specifically through the lens of racial conflict and those narratives being written by the winning or dominant side. It emerges in the 1980s as a branch of critical legal theory, specifically based in the American experience of racism and criticism of liberal concepts of fair treatment, which proponents believe merely support fairness to the dominant group on their terms. A well-known example of this is hostility to colorblind thinking, which is a liberal concept. Proponents of critical race theory want you to see race. They want you to understand the distinct experience of someone from a different cultural experience and your own implicit or unconscious biases as a result of your own cultural experience, or in the case of the dominant group in the West, our whiteness. When you're colorblind, they believe you're simply imposing your own values and how you wish to be treated on someone else, which then reinforces those dominant cultural values. They reject the idea that you can truly show empathy if you have not experienced what a person of color has experienced. You should simply listen and accept, which again becomes somewhat self-defeating and erases dialogue from any process of understanding. If you and I talk without there being any exchange, then what are we really learning from each other? If further you're not looking at racism in its full social context, and in particular from the perspective of the group towards whom racist attitudes are being expressed, then you're reinforcing rather than challenging racism. That in brief, and again noting this is really quite a huge area with many thousands of books written on it, is what critical race theory is and what we are challenging. If you look at the materials produced by Black Lives Matter on wider issues, it contains strong elements of this thinking alongside other tropes of the left, such as abolishing capitalism.
So in my view, this is a deeply regressive ideology or form of thinking that's sort of dressed up as being progressive in some way. How and why has this been incorporated into workplace policy, specifically HR practice?
That's a great question. The starting assumption of many corporations in 2020 was something needs to be done. Corporations love to show that they're doing things whenever there is a bad headline, and particularly if they're being told that doing nothing is a form of racism. So, many made statements. Many engaged in fundamental reviews of their policies, rooted in listening exercises, listening to people's lived experience of racism. Many implemented policies that address the need for change, particularly in regards to institutional racism or the policies and practices that encourage racism or racist outcomes. Or rather, the policies and practices campaigners told them that did that, often without much evidence that they did. They simply said, okay, you guys are very cross at the moment, we'll do that. So what does this include? So typically, and most famously, implicit bias or unconscious bias training. It includes support for workplace groups segregated by race, includes advising staff, again, segregated by race, about their white privilege. It includes accusing them of white fragility. It includes demands that they educate themselves if they're dissent from this characterization. Often they distribute very one-sided reading lists. Much of this stuff in turn has come out of American universities where woke students and academics have attempted to cancel each other for expressing disagreeable views for much of the last decade. It's not obvious that that is something that you wish to import into a workplace that has very little to do with campus culture. It includes data gathering on the basis of racial characteristics. It includes demands for publication of ethnic pay gaps based on the flawed model of measuring the gender pay gaps that have become policy in this country. And that's the subject on which Len Shackleton wrote last week. These are usually attached to demands that these gaps be reduced by paying some groups more than others until that gap has been reduced. Finally, it requires companies to evaluate all of their activities and communications on the basis as to whether or not they adequately reflect the diversity of the society around them and actively promote and prioritise underrepresented groups. And in the comments, I've attached two links to the Law Society of Scotland and Personnel Today as examples of some of this thinking in the HR trade. And just to be clear, some of this stuff is just extensions of sensible programmes that already exist to encourage diversity and inclusion in the workplace, often as a result where there is clear evidence that there being a problem. I think the best example of this is the Metropolitan Police. They do need to represent the groups that they police in order to establish mm-hmm. trust, in order to actually do their job of policing. They know they need to do this, and it's been a huge problem since the McPherson report that they're really trying very hard to address. So we're not saying that diversity and inclusion are wrong. We're saying that these critical race theory approaches to diversity and inclusion are unhelpful. So the issue is fundamentally how anti-racism can undermine programmes that might actually help.
So you argue in your article for 1828, which you can also, there's also a link to that in our comment box, in our description box. You argue in that article that anti-racism has become the thing it claims to seek to address. How so?
Well, first, most obviously, the problem with anti-racism, straightforwardly, it's racist. Fundamentally, it attributes pejorative tropes, ideas and stereotypes to people on the basis of the colour of their skin, white privilege being the most obvious example. Now, to be clear, the activists are aware of this, and you get into these extraordinary conversations trying to excuse why it's right in this case. So what they say is this doesn't really mean what you think it means. It's not just trying to insult white people. It's instead intended to describe the absence of something, the privilege of not experiencing racism. But, again, to be clear, this is nonsense on stilts. Apart from the point that plenty of white groups, from travellers to gypsies to Jews to Appalachian Hill folk, experience prejudicial abuse, there are plenty of ways of helping people understand things they do not themselves experience, that do not require using terms of racist abuse. You do not, for example, need to invent the concept of thin privilege to help people address their poor understanding of the lived experience of being fat.
Although that is something that they do bandy around.
Well, not often with a straight face, I think it's fair to say.
There is thin privilege.
I've heard the expression. Smart privilege, your lack of understanding for slow learners. Sight privilege for those who do not wear glasses. And brunette privilege for those who've never suffered a blonde or redhead joke. And to be clear, Emily, I do identify as a redhead, even though I do not have red hair. If activists use the expression black disadvantage rather than white privilege, which apparently means the same thing, it would feel jarring and wrong. And if that does, then why can't people see that white privilege is not a helpful term? It's also been noted in numerous studies, and quite unsurprisingly, that attempts to divide people by race or segregation, while insulting one group of them, can cause divisions more likely to encourage racism than tackle it. If your job is cleaning your offices and you're dragged into a workshop and told, the thing that we need to talk to you about today is not the quality of the cleaning, but why it is you need to address your historical white privilege, you're going to understandably feel a little bit resentful towards the person giving that training and wonder what the hell it has to do with your employment. So there's another response to this from activists who say, oh, no, you've completely misunderstood. This isn't racism. This is punching up. This is making assumptions about the dominant group, which is okay. Whereas what racism is punching down. And this is fascinating, but it's completely and self-evidently stupid and historically inaccurate, dangerously so. What is anti-Semitism if not punching up? What about the experience of Asians in Uganda, the Chinese minority in Malaysia, the violence against white farmers in Zimbabwe, if not racism rooted around a narrative of revenge on a dominant group? Encouraging hate is the problem, whether racism or any other ism. Racism further does not require a power narrative to be racism, nor does a power narrative justify racism. From this muddle, you get the left's current toxic mess over Israel and Palestine, where violence against Israel is seen as okay because they're the ones who are currently on the up, whereas violence against the Palestinians is seen as an outrage. I mean, it's clearly just nonsense. It encourages the self-justified violence of Antifa. You've all heard of Nazi punching. How on earth can people get into a mindset where they think it's okay to assault somebody simply because they disagree with their horrible views? It's also the idea that poor kids in Bolton should pay reparations for slavery to millionaire footballers. Again, how does that work? Why do people suddenly get into the mindset that that's a good thing, other than through this lens of punching up versus punching down? You also have to add in a lens of narrative exclusion. which is about the listening exercises, and this is about rendering disagreement as evidence of further privilege. So the expression white fragility, for example, is used to say what I'm doing now is showing my white fragility by disagreeing with the tenets of critical race theory. But when we do that, well, we're in the territory of making as an unfalsifiable argument. And we all know from understanding logic, this is simply a bad argument. Anything that you cannot falsify is not then subject to evidence. So any challenge to the truth of critical race theory tends to be met with either false allegations of racism or the shifting of the goalposts, which brings us back to the problem of postmodernism and the notion that there are no grand narratives. This must then surely include the idea of postmodernism itself and the ideas of critical race theory. The philosophy at the centre of the cancel culture then must ultimately cancel itself.
So when this approach is applied to HR policy, what problems have you identified? And how widespread is this way of thinking in UK businesses and organisations? Is it most corporations are now indulging in this kind of theory? Or is it just a few who are trying to virtue signal? How widespread is this problem?
I think on the widespread question, we are lacking data. So we're only a year into this clearly huge cultural trend, and those studies still need to be done. But there was quite a good example today of one of the many statements that have been made by many companies, and that was a story about our old friends at Oxfam. They're in the papers for having made their staff complete a survey on their whiteness, with one whistleblower noting, surely the time and money should be better spent on the real findings that some of the men they employ are sexual predators.
You might have thought.
I mean, just to be clear, Oxfam was censured by the Charity Commission for precisely that in 2018. Not just that, for the extremely poor way that they handled it. Their internal processes were terrible. They were turning a blind eye to practices that are clearly wrong. And both of those, both this survey and those practices, are textbook examples of policies creating a hostile working environment for a group of staff based, or their beneficiaries in the case of the sexual abuse, based on a protected characteristic. And that's discrimination. So any staff member suffering poor treatment as a result of refusing to complete the survey on their race will now have grounds to sue. Conversely, we can note some pushback against this trend and all these different approaches in the workplace, and that's come happily from central government. They've started to limit spending public money on diversity consultancies peddling training of dubious worth. And some of that training, to make it clear, could encourage workplace discrimination by creating polarisation.
Yes, I saw that they'd been spending hundreds of thousands of pounds in Whitehall on unconscious bias training. But yeah, as you said, thankfully that's been stopped now.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, there's plenty of HR training that can be considered to be of dubious scientific value. Unconscious bias training is no different. I've done it myself. And there are elements of it that are complete nonsense that use these tests and the implicit association tests, which don't really work. And there are elements of it that just encourage a decent discussion where you get to reflect on different ideas. Now, like the Myers-Briggs test, which is a very famous personality test, that's not scientifically valid, and it's not obvious that it actually encourages better behaviour. But it can be interesting in itself to get people out of their day-to-day routines and into training. So I would dismiss the industry entirely, but the claims that are made for it, that this will help you tackle racism in the workplace, are clearly not true. And that is a problem, and particularly a problem when you're spending public money. Let's look at this a little bit further. Workplace conduct is largely covered by employment law. It's already the case that direct and indirect discrimination on the grounds of race, as well as eight other protected characteristics, is illegal. Firms that don't take that seriously already find themselves on the wrong end of employment tribunals, as well as having their reputations trashed. You do not want to be a firm that has credible allegations of racism made against you. You've got to be a particularly bad employer to allow a culture that encourages racism. This generally doesn't include major corporations or public sector bodies, although now appears to include the corporate charity that is Oxfam. Workplace conduct isn't, to be clear again, covered by social justice theories of structural unfairness. Well, it's quite interesting to consider whether someone's ancestors' experience of racism is in some way responsible for their position in society today, it's also a banal statement of the bleeding obvious. We are all, to a greater or lesser extent, the products of the horrors of history paradox. I, for example, exist because of the Holocaust. My family were literally enslaved by Nazis in the 1940s, and many were killed. My grandfather escaped Germany, was interred, and his son was born in Birmingham. On the English side of my family, it's entirely possible that my ancestors were both profiteers and victims of slavery. were any, for example, victims of the Viking raids from their slave trading port in Dublin? Did they fight off the Barbary pirates? Were they Romans or subjugated by Romans? Who, on that basis, do I sue for compensation? What pay rise should I get from the IEA for this history? Who should I be apologising to for that privilege? Should I be apologising to myself, given my dual heritage? The questions are completely mad and they've got nothing to do with employing people, dignity at work, or protecting people from discrimination. These questions all at root require employers to treat people as individuals, to expect those individuals to treat others likewise, and to examine the evidence of what they actually do and reward them accordingly or punish them accordingly. There's no workplace process that I can think of that can benefit from an addition of a layer of critical race theory. Conversely, if you do apply this layer, forcing staff to confront their privilege based on race, taking people at their word that they've experienced racism without evidence, treating white staff differently and prejudicially in order to redress unequal outcomes from history, then you are almost certainly breaking employment law. You are discriminating and you are subjecting your workforce to policies that encourage a culture of discrimination. Claiming in response to that you're just punching up or showing allyship or otherwise bringing crank politics, the hard left, into the workplace is not going to save you from the employment tribunal.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I think in the US they're taking this far further than we are here. We're always a little bit of a step behind. Apparently McDonald's is looking to, or has already, decided to link executive pay to diversity and inclusion quotas. So thereby people of ethnic minority backgrounds may, or women, may indeed get a bigger pay packet on the grounds of their race or sex, which is an interesting one.
Well, I mean, and that's their choice. And if I was on the receiving end of that pay rise, because they also decided that half Jewish people whose family's been persecuted by the Holocaust was worthy of compensation, I'd be thinking, hooray. The problem then comes if you are the executive who happens to have German heritage, who was born in the United States. You're thinking, well, I work for this company and here's my performance. Why is it that I'm only due this pay rise of zero? And that person then has grounds for a discrimination claim if they can demonstrate that they have been treated unfairly on grounds of their race.
Well, it's just madness. Anyway, so if this is the wrong approach that you've sort of outlined to handling allegations of discrimination, what would be preferable? Clearly, prejudice is real and it can manifest itself in discriminatory behaviour. What should the right approach be in your view?
Well, I agree with that. And I've sat on anti-racism groups. In my life as a counsellor, the meetings I attended, the resounding message from black staff was that more attention was needed to handling and dealing with actual claims of racism, not all the structural social stuff. Much of that to them sounds like excuse-making and virtue signalling for not doing that basic job of investigating claims and dealing with clear and evidential cases of prejudice and racism, which points in turn to what the right approach should be. And here at the IEA, our policies on dignity at work are very clear. We apply the Human Rights Act, we take allegations of racism seriously, and we will investigate them and treat all parties to any such dispute fairly. That was our policy before 2020, and it's been updated with only one new line as a result of all of this. And that line is this: the company does not support critical theory or postmodernism as applied to claims of discrimination on the presumption of implicit or unconscious bias in individuals or groups. We regard it as a form of discrimination to presume that someone holds particular views without evidence that they do, based purely on identity traits. What we're doing there is we want to be clear with people that if they attempt to use racist arguments to advance a particular agenda, they will be treated as racist arguments and rejected. We want to be clear that if they expect differential treatment on the grounds of race or a narrative about race claims unsupported by evidence, they will be listened to. Evidence will be expected to follow. We're not making decisions on the basis of people proclaiming their truth or attacking others as prejudice for questioning their truth. So in other words, we will uphold the current law, rooted as it is in Enlightenment values, reason and fair treatment. We're not going to embrace this narrative of conflict where groups seeking class war in the 20th century are now using race to the same end. Anti-racism requires you to call out racism where you see it. Anti-racism is racist. We're calling it out and we're keeping it out of our workplace. Others could do likewise.
That's brilliant to hear. I hope other companies, businesses, charities and so on will look to us as a template if the tide changes on this sort of thing. Thank you so much for joining me on the IEA podcast. If you would like to read Andy's article in 1828, please use the link in the description box. It's a really brilliant article and sort of looks at what we've discussed today. So thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please do leave a comment and subscribe and share with your friends, family, colleagues and wider networks. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify, or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.